Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Mangum Talks TV. I am your hoarse, raspy, recovering host, Lee, and I am here with the man who's going to do the bulk of the talking today, my wonderful podcast co-host, Spencer. Spencer, how are you?
I'm just happy to be visiting you in hospice. You know, I didn't expect to be recording on your deathbed, but here we are.
Look, I'm not saying this sounds good, but I am saying it sounds a heck of a lot better than where I was about a week ago. I have lost my voice now. This is like day 10 of struggling with voice issues. But after watching episode 7, I felt like we could not lay off this week. This episode, Chikai Bardo, required a check-in. Spencer, we have not talked since episode 6, or episode 5, so we have episode 6 and 7 to recover, to review
today.
And cover today. Before we do so, I'll give a quick update. I got like a cold of some kind that clearly turned into laryngitis. Spencer, you were with me last weekend, and I was struggling to speak then. I've kind of not been able to speak this entire week. We had a lot of people write in who were really cool about it, who understood that, you know, the reason we had to take a week off from the podcast. I appreciate all the well wishes. I think I'm on the mend, and I know this isn't super fun to listen to, so I'll try to do a little less talking this episode, as I referenced in the intro. But again, on the mend, doing our best, and we will do our best to review episode 6 and 7 today of Severance season 2. With that, Spencer, what did you think of episode? Let's start with 6, and then you can bleed into 7 and your thoughts.
Episode 6, Attila. I was already curious what it was going to be given the title. Did not end up going where I thought it was going to do with respect to the title. Do you know many couples that do those kind of pet names that are just inherently critical, but for some reason that's just how they refer to each other?
Always. I mean, I feel like it's like 90% of couples, right?
Couples, you come up with friends, little, whatever else, yeah.
A little passive-aggressive nickname. We call you, I don't know that we've ever talked about this on the podcast. Our friends group calls you Pants.
Yeah.
P-A-N-T-S. And I'm not really sure where it started, but we just call you Pants.
A friend one day called me Spencer Pants, and for some reason that just took off in a way I did not expect.
It's weird because you're such a serious person. Like, you're like a very successful serious person, and then like your friends come around and go, Pants! Which, same dynamic here with this couple, right? Seemingly very serious couple, very serious people in the world, and they call each other Attila.
I liked Attila. I thought it was a good episode. I thought it was an interesting episode. It was a very relationship-focused episode, kind of revolving around three different sets of characters. But I ended the episode just going, oh, well, that was an interesting episode. I'll be curious to see where it goes from here. Then we got, we agreed in advance on the pronunciation, Chikai Bardo.
Chikai Bardo, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That may be my favorite episode of the damn series. That one hit me like a truck. That was incredibly emotionally affecting. I was reeling throughout moments in this episode. By the end of that, you know, I've been fighting on the subject of, man, you know, Mark's, you know, willing to risk a lot to go save his wife. Man, Ragabi's really pushing some of the envelope here in a way I'm not comfortable with. I ended the episode basically like, how can I help? I need to burn this fictional corporation to the damn ground. It for a relationship that's really only been existing on paper and through vague descriptions of how other characters react, including Mark, we got to see one episode seeing it live and breathe, and I felt it, I lived it, I was affected by it, and I need to see more of it, and it makes a show that I was hoping was going to be at least 3 seasons now could be a struggle for me, because if I don't see some measure of resolution to the hell that they put her in, purgatory maybe based on the title, or limbo, I don't know what I'm going to do. I want some resolution that end of this season just because of how powerful this episode 7 was. So episode 6, a good episode. Episode 7, all-timer for me.
That's about where I fall. I was a little less positive about episode 7 the first time I watched it, and then I watched it a second time, and I was like, this is brilliant. There's a lot of little stuff they do. I'll call one out as an example. In episode 7, when you are in Severance, like you are either on... We spend most of our time on the floor under the floor that we've been on, right? We're almost like a sort of medicinal, like hospital type room.
Properly hell, basically. It is the floor below.
Where Gemma is. Like, we spend most of our time there. When we're there, excuse me. When we're there, it's like we're a participant. The camera angle is steady. We are head high. We watch folks as if we're sort of an omnipresent, you know, character. Mm-hmm. when we are outside of Lumen, the camera's shaky. Often we're behind plants. It's like we're seeing something we're not supposed to see. That was one small example, but there's a ton of them through that. It's an imminently rewatchable episode. I thought it was maybe like an 8 when I watched it the first time, and I'm at like 9, 5, 10 after watching it the second time. I thought they took an awful lot of care. And another thing I'll point out, I'm doing a great job not talking a lot, aren't I? This is really good.
Can't help it, folks.
Another point I'll say is I think longtime listeners of the podcast know that I enjoy a good romance. Like unabashedly, I like romance in a story. Romance to me is almost similar to horror in that when I want a good romance story, like I'll watch cheesy romance just to watch it because I want that. So I root for romantic interest in these stories in a sort of non-satirical, like not ironic way. Like I pick a couple I like, I root for them.
And in light of that, how fast were you sold on their relationship when it came to the episode?
Yeah, you see exactly where I'm driving at is that I was so into Mark and Helly that the prospect of Gemma re-entering for Mark was almost inconvenient, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now I am so sold on Mark Gemma. Like it's a wrap, folks. Same. Like the idea of Mark Helly is on the mat sleeping. And I know that any Mark and Audi Mark are different. But I think my rooting interest now firmly lies in Mark and Gemma. And I had the thought too, and I don't know if you wondered about this, is we got the sense that Mark really loved Gemma,
yes.
But we didn't get any of the flashbacks or backstory until fairly late in this story. It feels like, could they have benefited by giving us some of that before showing them together beforehand?
Perhaps, but I almost feel like this episode was stronger that it was our first opportunity to actually experience it with them. That previously it was just little moments of flashback, descriptions, particularly like Devin responding for, you know, what their relationship was and what they lost, whatever else, or Rickon even talking about it too. Almost less from Mark because we just got to see his pain. To see it all now piled into this episode and have it be told primarily from Gemma's perspective, I think in some ways made this episode more powerful, but I do wonder to what degree it has deprived us of, you know, that kind of buildup. I think I fall into the camp of I like it that it has been kept away from us to now suddenly be revealed because it just made us suddenly shift on a dime. Like, I was with you. Gemma was someone I sympathized with. I was sad for Mark in terms of what he was going through, but I was very much getting dedicated to Mark and Helly's relationship. Now that I've seen what their relationship was, what has been taken through them, what has been done to Gemma, who is awake, aware, and herself in a way I did not see coming, I'm having difficulty dealing with that. It was so effectively done. So I think they could have bled it in a little bit more, but I rather like what they've done here in terms of keeping it away from us to now reveal it focused on her and her own perspective of the world.
Yeah, you mentioned Rickon. How wonderful was it that Rickon was into climbing and used all those weird climbing terms that climbing folks do, like belay and crimp and carabiner and all these terms. Like I know some people who like to climb and you hear, it's like another language that they use. That was like a perfect little detail for him. I thought it was a particularly strong episode for Devin.
Oh yes.
I really, really like that character. What did you think of her insertion in episode 7 into the plot?
I love that they sold what she'd already told us previously to Mark about, Mark, you weren't the only person that lost something here. Because we got to see how close of a relationship that she and Rickon had with both Mark and Gemma. That, if anything, Gemma was the one that was quietly revealing to Devin first about the fact that she was pregnant. And then we started to see that when Mark was disassembling that crib upstairs as violently as possible, which is a rending scene, it was Devin that came up next to her at the sink and was going to tell her. The two of them were friends. And getting to see that part of their mutual relationship between the couples was really great. And then getting to see Devin being the one that we always thought, you know, talk about relationships in the show, her and Mark are the one true close relationship without any romantic edge attached to it. Getting to see her struggling and dealing with the Ragavan Mark situation and be there the one that, you know, he wakes up to it there at the end was all really well done. So yeah, extra time spent with Devin is always going to be a treat. How it was handled this episode, all-star.
Little factoid for you. So the actress who plays Devin is Jen Tulloch. historically, has done a lot of stage acting. Jen Tulloch improvised the line where she said that she had a crush on the lady who the senator's wife who was giving birth.
Last episode, yeah.
Sort of creating a backstory that Devin is queer, right? That's how she's described it, is that she believes Devin is queer, and did that line and created that backstory for us. And I'm not always into when actors are, you know, straight and sort of force a character down being straight or gay, or force a character down being gay. Like a character does not have to mirror the actor, right? That's obvious.
Sure.
In this case though, I think that really works for Devin. Like when I got that detail, I was like, yes, that is the character. She's probably dated people of all backstories, all gender types, all in the spectrum. She's probably worked all types of jobs. That felt very appropriate person for that world. Character for me. I liked that detail too.
She's always been a wonderful character, and it seems like that they're going to make her even more front and center. Well, front and center in a way she wasn't in season one, that she's going to be an additional driving force for the plot, and I'm all here for that. If she is now integrally involved in Mark and Rigabi and everyone else's crusade to take down Lumen, let me hoist the banner. I'm behind the cause.
Another little, I feel like all I'm doing is pointing out like little stuff and not addressing the major plot points, which we will address.
I got a list. We'll get there.
Another little thing I really liked is just getting some time with Devin, Rickon, Gemma, and Mark around a dinner table where they're just chatting, because you got the impression that when Devin was saying, you're not the only one who lost somebody, she was being honest, and she had a real justification for that position and that conversation that happened a few episodes back. You also got the sense though that Rickon's craziness has always been sort of compartmentalized in that group, and with the absence of Gemma and Mark sort of going MIA, it ballooned, right? Like his craziness sort of kind of got out of control for Devin.
One of our favorite scenes we talked about in season one was getting to have a moment with Rickon where he just talked about how much he enjoyed going out with him, how much he enjoyed spending time with him, how much he missed not having Jim in his life. Getting another scene of that, and now we get to see that he was the one that introduced mountain climbing to them, that he was the one that was into it first, and they were kind of mocking him for him. It felt like that was like one of the first times that they'd really hung out in terms of, you know, like, oh, look, here's a picture of him, you know, climbing this rock wall. Isn't it nuts? And then near the end of the episode, it's Gemma that sends Mark, you know, have you looked at that, what I sent you about Denali, about they got into climbing, they got into hiking, they got into doing something as a couple, so they did together, which what Rickon referenced previously. So getting moments of Rickon being grounded or as part of not his other social group is just great, because you can get to see what close friends they were before, as you said, the balance was thrown off and he disappeared into his own little world of weirdness.
Devin absolutely had a live music phase, right?
Oh, yes.
Where she was going to all the concert halls. She knew all of the local pop punk bands.
She was in a band or three.
Yeah, had to. Like, there was a rebellious streak a mile long of that character. I really like the fleshing out of the backstory of that character. And the four of them around the table. And I'll tell you another thing they did here. And I don't know if you feel this way, but I was watching the character of Gemma get really filled in episode 7. Mm-hmm. And I had the thought, I think I would kill someone for this woman. Like, I think I might be in love with this fictional character that I've only known for one episode. They made her extremely appealing and really sympathetic, super baby face for Gemma. And I feel like that is not good for her character long-term, but that's where we are.
It gives them a lot of different ways to use the character to emotionally manipulate the shit out of us in a way they've already been doing with Mark. So
Was the moment
crystallized it though, when she went proper WWE and went over the top with the plastic chair on that doctor from hell?
The chair shot on the doctor. Let's look up the doctor's name, because the doctor clearly has a problem.
Dr. Maurer.
That's right.
I knew played by Robbie Benson, who did very well with the role. I don't think I know the actor, but man, did he effectively make him hate him. It just almost more than I've hated any other character in this show in the course of one episode.
Yeah. What did you think of that line? You know, when, like, I think it was, I can't remember the guy's name who said it to her, but he said it to Maurer when he goes, you know, when this is over, you're going to have to let go of her, or something along those lines.
Doesn't respond, just walks away. And then one of the next scenes we get of him is when he, in that room alone with Gemma, tells her, you know, I'm really looking forward to seeing Mark. And he's like, Mark's moved on, got married over a year ago, and he had a daughter. you absolute son of a whore. Just, no. You do not play that pressure point in a way that only you would know that from manipulating and controlling every aspect of this woman's life for the last 2 years.
She didn't. I don't think she believed it, although it did make her pretty desperate, I felt like.
That aspect of where he is clearly developing an emotional attachment to this person and making her say, I love you, back to him, and role-playing out all of these different moments in life, all apparently unpleasant moments that Backerdate or Fiming went through, which we'll get to that. And then trying to, like, maybe you've had moments in each of these rooms that were different or even better than your relationship with Mark, and then trying to undermine a relationship with Mark. It was already hateful. Now it's toxic and manipulative in an old kind of personal way. I despise that character. Well done, show.
I agree. Certainly, you know, abusive to her. And you get a weird thing there. There's a weird dynamic.
It's not just for Lumen, it's for his own personal gratification. That makes it so much worse, I guess.
Yeah, not healthy. I will say that I'm ready to award actor of the series, though. I know the series isn't over. It might go on 2-3 more years, but I am ready to give the trophy now to someone.
Go on.
Britt Lauer, who plays Helly, or Helena.
Both.
To me, this is a masterclass. When she sits down in that diner with Mark.
Oh, the restaurant table, yeah.
She had to pull off so much in that scene because Helena is trying to be like almost like a salesman for herself and for Lumen to Mark. She's trying to be warm, but in being warm, she also, Britt Lauer, had to show you that she isn't really. So there had to be little slips here and there, but it also had to connect to the humanity of Helly, because I feel like I saw so much Helly in her banter with Mark there. But there was this undercurrent of insincerity that she allowed to slip in through it, that Mark eventually picked up on, that spurred his actions later in episode 6. I felt like that was an extremely difficult scene to act for Britt Lauer, and she's done it. And her back and forth between her innie and her outie is the most extreme of any of them, because they've made her outie the ultimate big boss, the final boss of the show. She's like the worst, right? But they've made her innie almost the biggest baby face of the whole group. So it's wonderful.
A baby face who in the course of the episode has to be asked, you didn't punch him, did you? Well, no, not this time. She's an aggressive baby face, but it's a category.
I've just been extremely impressed with how she's able to sort of deftly switch back and forth in those characters. But even having these characters that are so on the polar opposite of our rooting interest, to be able to show that they are fundamentally coming from the same human, right? That there's a connection in those two, because I see Helly in Helena's actions and I see some of Helena when Helly gets fired up.
It's really interesting to say, I'm right there with you. And it makes one wonder, one of the central themes of the show being, are these effectively, as the show is often posited, the same person that had been just given different experiences? And you can see a certain aspect of that with Helena, that there is an undercurrent of Helly with so much of her family obscuring it or taking it away from that particular path. And it almost, let's go through a few scenes. Let's talk about that scene first when it comes to that diner. I'm curious of your thoughts of what the purpose of Helena going there is. Because it was obviously conscious. There's no reason that she just ended up at that particular Chinese restaurant on that day in that town at that place. Their driver waiting out front.
You didn't like that. Look at the classism coming in there at a Spencer.
You're feeling my anger there? Yeah, I felt did, that. Yeah. Chinese food. Invite the damn driver in. Let him at least get a cookie.
My goodness, yes. Feed him. Feed the driver.
She consciously went to Mark. She did her pitch, like you said, walking him through Lumen. I'm the big boss of Lumen. But at the same time, it was a very flirtatious conversation.
Yep.
It was a conversation that was not just pitch. It was a certain element of they actually seemed like they had a bit of a vibe that worked for a second before Mark pulled away hard when the pitch became too much of the vibe. But a couple things I found interesting there is, one, it validates a theory that you had previously of where I don't think that she was being false or lying or hiding anything when she talked about, you know, I'll take you home to dad. And he's like, oh, you bring her to see your dad. And she kind of shrugs and says, well, you'd be the first. I think that was pretty truthful. You talked about that previously. Yeah. that, you know, she comes across as a person that has not had much in the way of relationships because of her family, because of her expectations, the responsibilities that were assigned to her from birth. That felt like that was a very revealing line of, okay, maybe she's here because this is, in many ways, the first thing that she's ever had resembling a romantic relationship, or one that actually might, she feels like there actually might be a connection, independent of her name or background or anything else associated with it. I also found it very interesting and very intentional that she said Gemma's name wrong. That she said Hannah, I think it was.
Hannah, that's what she said, yeah.
That felt like a test. And the only reason I could think of why that would be a test is where she's actually trying to go into a certain degree, is this Innie or is this Audi Mark?
Yep.
I don't think that's even just bleed through. It feels like that was very much is who am I talking to right now kind of test. And why she would be testing that is interesting. Is it a certain degree whether she's testing whether Severance is working or not? Is it she wondering whether the, you know, outdoor contingency scenario, whatever it's called, is actually flipping on or off or applying, or whether, you know, some shenanigans are at play? Is it whether, I don't know exactly. Or she's testing reintegration to a certain degree. I'm not sure, but that felt like a very conscious effort that made me wonder whether this meeting is not just simply personal. There is pitch, there was a personal element, but there felt like a test element that I wasn't expecting there, and I wasn't quite sure how to interpret. What are your thoughts on that scene? I've been yammering away about it.
No, I'm right there with you. I think that my impression is that when he got the nosebleed in the elevator, they were watching, of course, and they've connected the nosebleed to reintegration.
Yeah.
And they know that that's happening. So there was a comment in episode 7, like he's gotten to 96%, but he's stuck after the nosebleed. He's stuck, right? That he's starting to reintegrate for whatever reason. And I think she was testing to see if he was reintegrated, any mark, if he had lost memories in that process, because she was too, the throwing out of the wrong name was clearly on purpose, because she had every other fact right. I mean, she had everything sort of memorized about this guy. And I do think they vibe. I do think that was real from Helena. Here's Helena for me. Helena is Darth Vader and her dad is the Emperor. And at some point, Mark as Luke will be making the pitch to Helena to come to the light side.
Is Mark Luke or is Heli Luke? Or are they both different aspects of Luke?
I think Heli is Anakin. And I think that Luke, Mark, will be pushing hard at some point in this story for Helena to come over to the light side. Helena at some point will betray her father and will betray Lumen. Because a central idea of this show is that the Innie and the Audi are the same person. They're split consciousness, but they come from the same place. They're the same person. And they can't have that be what I believe is what they're asserting. Like if they are asserting that, then they are going to have to square the circle of Helena and Heli at some point. And I think the way they do that is to show that, yes, Helena is cruel. Yes, Helena is awful, but she's been raised to be that. But there is a kernel of good inside her, and that's going to be pulled out. Obviously, it's very clear that I watch these shows for characters. I like characters, right?
characters but that's, and relationships and shipping. This man is the shipping king.
But that's what I took from that conversation was, yes, she's there. She's testing the reintegration. She's being manipulative. It's in coordination with Lumen and the board and her father and all of that. But despite her intentions, she enjoyed her time with Mark and she likes Mark. And that's going to matter. They wouldn't throw that into the story if it didn't matter.
Which makes it interesting to think that I'm with you. That's definitely a possible arc that we could see Helena go through. And it could just simply be that Mark's the first thing outside of her family and Lumen that she's really been exposed to in a way that wasn't just purely controlled by them. It is an opportunity to see an alternative life that she never had a real chance to have.
I don't think I don't think they're going here. But it could be interesting if they equate this like insular Lumen family to like military or not military, I'm sorry, religious cult.
Mm-hmm.
And that time in the tent could have been Helena's first time having sex with anybody. Right. Mm-hmm. That would add a real interesting kernel to that story.
What's the term in the Amish culture? It's like Ramspringa when they send the Amish kids away.
Rumspringa. Yeah.
Rumspringa. her time as an innie, you know, faking that was her rumspringa. It was her time away from her family in a way she probably never had before, and she's
not able
to let it go.
Yeah, it could spur change later on. I think that's a very reasonable way to take that story, because they can't have her be as evil as she always is and have Helly stay the consistent character that we know Helly is. It just doesn't square to me.
Which makes it interesting, because we previously talked about how we expected some aspects of that with Milchick, but rather than an outside influence, it's the effect of Lumen upon him that he's seemingly pulling away from. Though in this episode, episode 6, there was a conscious effort at confessional reaffirmation, pulling away all aspects of self-loathing or everything other than the perfect part of himself that he wants to emulate but feels like he can't be, in that very interesting scene occurring with him just staring in the mirror after going through I don't even know how many TPS reports by means of getting the paper clips right. It's in his language, in his actions, even as the camera is framing it in, it's peeling away every part of himself that he despises, that he does not feel is in Lumen and Kier's image, even ending on words of where the first sentence is the most crystal clear, you know, Milchick ever, you must eradicate from your essence childish folly. But by the end of it, it's down simply to the word grow. And previously, he's a bit off-center because it's not focused on him, it's on everything else, but then the camera by the end is focused in and zoomed in, and it is only him, it is only a part of him he wants to mold and create so he can be in the best image of Kier that he feels is necessary, but now just focused on a single word, grow. It was a hard scene, it was a well-acted scene, the actor does great with this role, but it makes me wonder, we've been pondering to what degree Milchick would be our heel face. Turn over the course of the series, and I still think that's possible, but I think it's either going to be delayed, or there's going to be a conscious effort on his part to avoid it or fight it, to really make, if that's his end game, it feels like it's being pushed a little bit farther off as a result of how much that review affected upon him over the course of the last couple episodes.
Yeah, it feels like Milchick's journey might be somewhat more individual. You know, him dealing with the racism of the organization, the marginalization that he's had as a dynamic in his job, and him coming to terms with the idea that he can be an independent person and he can like sort of unshackle himself from that corporate bondage. Like, I feel like that's where they're maybe going with history. Maybe his story won't be quite as connected to Lumen has to be. We have to take Lumen down. We have to free the innies. It's more, I am overcoming myself. I'm on a personal journey of liberation. And I think that'll be really fulfilling when we see him do that. And I'm sure some of his actions will be important. But my feeling is that Helena's heel turn is what will come. That's when the company starts to really go down.
I'm with you there. Milchick's journey feels...
baby face turn.
Milchick's journey feels much more individual. It feels much more about finding himself independent of others. He doesn't have anyone to turn to. He's tried, and people have pulled away from, you know, assisting him in this regard. He doesn't have, you know, the manic pixie dream guy that Helena has for Mark, by comparison, to help him through this, you know, journey of self-discovery. It's really a sense of identity rebelling against the box that the world is trying to put it in. I'll be very curious to see where they ultimately go with that, because it has some of the similar notes, but it's much more... He's finding it himself, and I'll be curious to see what they ended up doing with that.
So I miss Dylan in these episodes. I really miss Zach Cherry. That was that didn't have nearly enough of him.
But we did what him and Gretchen doesn't, you know, isn't that a relationship you're invested in?
Well, we knew that was coming, right? That was happening, and that was a very short part of episode 6. I felt like, and then he was almost non-existent in episode 7. What did you think of Irving and Bert? And that whole weird dinner party.
Well, I don't trust Bert as far as I can throw him. I have the same amount of doubts about Bert that Dylan originally had about Bert back when they were still on the severed floor together.
Trust Dylan. Can we please get a t-shirt printed up?
I don't trust Bert to the point I'm wondering whether he was ever actually severed, kind of thing, of level of not trust at this point. This guy in my mind has died in the wool Lumen. He's been with Lumen for 20 years. Thank you, Fields, for giving us that information. Not 12. He was with Lumen before the whole severed floor thing even became a thing. I think he's still with Lumen now. I think he purposely got Irving over to his house to allow Drummond to raid through Irving's files. That's what I assume about that. I think I wonder at this point whether Fields is even the one that's responsible for some of the artwork that we've gotten to see in some of the halls or whatever else, because some of the artwork on their walls more than vaguely resembled some of the artwork we've seen on the severed floor. These guys are, they are the beating heart of Lumen, in my view, from what we got to see of them. And I think everything we got to see in that scene, it should be subject to doubt and it should be viewed as profoundly manipulative.
I got nothing more to say on that. That is exactly how I read that. Now the idea that he was never severed is very intriguing to me. That I hadn't really fleshed that one out, but I'm not against it because my bullshit meter is very, is in the red. My bullshit meter's in the red whenever Bert's on screen.
And one of the biggest things we have to further validate that we're burying the needle on the bullshit meter is how much Fields was just actively unable to avoid calling out Bert's bullshit over the course of the scene that they had together.
Right.
He was consistently pointing out problems. He basically said, yeah, my husband's going to hell for all the shit that he's done in his life. I wonder to what degree... I want to trust Fields probably more than I should, just because he's openly calling out things and seemingly rebelling against the narrative that he's being forced to, hold to deceive Irving. Did you buy anything about... how did you feel about their Lutheran church explanation for innies and outies having different souls, and I wanted him to be severed so that at least a part of him would have a chance to go to heaven? Bullshit, or was there some truth there?
I think we could do a two-hour podcast on how the show is portraying Lumen as a connection or a melding, let's say a melding of where you work, how you participate in religion, where you go to worship, and your governance and your government, mm-hmm. and how all three of those things can be profoundly powerful in someone's life to the point of abject manipulation of society. And the show is calling that out by blending them all in Lumen. They're in Kier. They have that's the state. That's the country that I think that they live in is Kier. I don't know if it's part of the United States.
It's at least a city.
They live in Kier, right? So there is a governmental structure that is Kier. Obviously, there's the corporate apparatus, and there's this overarching sort of embedding of religion in all of it. Mm-hmm. And the show is combining those three elements in a way that's really interesting. I think that they're not Lutheran. I think they're whatever the Kier people are. But it's close enough to explain, the best lies are rooted in truth, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's enough to explain their interest in these things and maybe why they act the way that they do. But I think their religion is based on Kier, just like the rest of them, right?
The fact that all these people live in Kier, we don't know how that works. We don't know what the governmental structure of that town is. We have to assume, based on the name, that it is, at least a Salt Lake City kind of connection in terms of religion and government blending together. But it raises doubts to what degree we can ever say any of these people aren't Lumen or Kier people. They're in the town. They're all connected with it. But Burton Fields in particular, they are dyed in the wool long term, long before anybody else was connected to this company. Just to hit on the Gretchen Dillon thing, I'm with you. I wasn't surprised anywhere of where that went, when it came to either the two of them, any Dillon and Gretchen creating a relationship and then Gretchen hiding that from Audi Dillon. It was the most, I think it was still well handled, but for me it was the most, predictable kind of aspect of the plot when it's come to this season so far.
I'd like to give Audi Dillon some romantic advice.
Mm-hmm.
I know he listens to the pod.
He does, yeah.
Audi Dillon.
A lot of time at home.
Leave your wife now, and not for the cheating. I'm not even sure if it's cheating. I don't know how that works. I'm not interested in that.
It's cheating. It's conscious cheating.
I am more interested in when you have a partner that starts to see you as a fuck up and there starts to be these tests that you are not in control of. It's not an effort test. It's an outcome test. Are you going to get the job? If your partner is testing you with, are you going to get the job? My advice is leave that partner. Go to a partner whose test is, will you try to get the job?
Mm-hmm.
The thing you can control. Do they see
support
the effort
rather than check boxes?
Do they see the effort as attractive? Do they see the effort, the thing that you can control, as something they want to hitch their life to? But when they're judging you on outcomes that you can't control, you are rolling the dice with your life going forward. And I'd bail on her in a heartbeat. It's not that I'm saying she's a bad person. I mean, she's probably really profoundly disappointed that this hasn't worked and that she doesn't find him attractive as a life partner anymore.
It's understandable, but.
Right. But Audi Dillon, my final word on this, not a sustainable relationship. He needs to leave.
Do you think any, based on some of the comments we got from Annie Dillon and some of the actions that he engaged in this episode, do you think, if you had to bet odds going into this episode versus now, that he would try to find a way to eliminate Audi Dillon and just be the only Dillon, how much of those odds increased this episode? Episode 6, that is. We didn't get to see him at all in episode 7, I don't think.
I think Annie Dillon would be interested in that if it gets pitched to him, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And I don't love that, but I don't know how this is where we can start to get into the sort of sci-fi of it. I don't know how the mechanics of this world would allow it. Like they would have to bring them all there. Right. Like, I mean, it seems like one of the core rules is that is the split of the consciousness. Now you could do the overtime contingency thing. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that would be one way to do it, but that seems to do it. Doesn't that do it for everybody?
I don't know. I mean, it seems now that we know that they can be out in the woods, out in the world as innies, seemingly for days, going to sleep, or is out, yeah, innies, go to sleep, function, not just as, you know, a matter of holding a physical switch, but just something they can turn on and off and be that way, then you could be the innie forever, seemingly. That's yeah. Something that they can just flip as being a different aspect of or a wave of your identity, however they're choosing to define this.
You've talked me into it, because I do think when they did the overtime contingency, it was multiple buttons for each of the people. So you could just do it for just Dillon to kill the Audi. I'll bet that's where they're going. I like that theory.
That's something I'm pondering now, and that's going to be interesting to see how it's handled, because Gretchen seems like she wouldn't oppose it, or if anything, be actively trying to encourage it. Maybe in a way that even Dillon might recoil from once it's actually presented to him, but stands to be seen. But
a divorce her. Audi Dillon. Get a divorce.
I think I'll admit at this point how wrong I was about Miss Huang being severed. I think at this point, with it being labeled out that she's more in like the mold of like a Cobell, of where from what I've seen now, that she's just raised, grown up in the system on a fellowship, as they're describing it right now. And apparently the process of that fellowship, similar as it was for Milchick, that she's just accumulated a vast set of skills to assist in all aspects of working on the severed floor. That she knows how to take blood pressure. She knows how to use the theremin. I don't know why that would come up in training, but apparently it does. She knows how to carve a fruit head. It's my best guess that she's the one that did that. I'm getting more and more that no, she is a Milchick. She is not severed, but this is the process of someone being raised their entire life in the system of Lumen. It does not create a perfectly well-rounded, functional human being. It is a collection of skills for a singular purpose, and everything around the margins of interacting with another normal person is just left by the wayside.
There's an element of Lumen that is a religious cult, I believe.
100%.
And I don't know that I've ever seen a portrayal, or maybe not a portrayal, but I don't know that I've ever seen someone who has come from a religious cult, right? Who gets followed for documentaries or whatever, come out like super well functioning, right? Like, I mean, that's kind of the idea, is that it's debilitating to your development. So I think it's an interesting idea that she's as weird as she is because of her environment, not because of some procedure or science or something. It's just, she's been raised to be that thing that we're seeing, which appears to me to be very stunted in her development and her social ability.
And I love the little human elements that have bled through despite that. She clearly is stunted on particularly a social kind of perspective. This is seemingly everybody associated with here is dream suite.
Except Milchick. Milchick's got it. He's a very charismatic guy. You see that dance scene in season one? He can boogie.
Yeah, but too many words. We've talked about this. Get better about that.
Too many words.
Can't
you just talk like a normal person?
Feels like too many notes for Amadeus, but yeah, it also has an uppity kind of connection we talked about previously. One other Lumen employee that I think this bleeds into both episodes, Rigabi.
And the whole
literal freaking hole in a head thing. I wasn't expecting that. I thought they would at least, you know, put like a something to seal up that gap more than it just being there. My level of distrust for that character has gone up over the course of these two episodes. Where previously she was the one that was trying to hold Mark back to some degree about, we need to be careful about this, we need to be measured, I've gotten better about it, but I want to be safe this time. And these last two episodes, She goes, we need to go faster. I'm not even going to tell you. I'm just going to inject something on there. Just hold still and do this. And oh, if you don't do this, I'm going to get mad at you. To in the next episode, oh, you're not doing exactly what I want? Okay, I'm just gone and leaving your brother maybe dead there on the floor. Now, admittedly, I wouldn't trust Cobell either, and Devon wasn't being very compromising herself. Two characters that I want to like not talking with each other. Well, Devon I do like, but not talking with each other and being open about their feelings. Seeing how that played out. But Rigabi feels like a bit of a, you know, a person that's turned away from their faith and is now a holy crusader against it, and is willing to break some eggs in the process of doing that in a way that makes me not trust her because I care about the eggs.
Interesting. I like how you got there. Look at that. That was very good. I think she's a prototypical revolutionary in this story, that her goal is to destroy Lumen. It's not necessarily to help Mark or others.
Or Jenna, certainly.
So that's going to rub up against each other with that character. She is willing to throw the firebomb into the facility, and if it kills innocents, who cares? We have to get rid of the corporation at all cost. And I think that that's how she's going to operate, and it'll be incumbent upon Devon to keep the guardrails around her such that Mark is protected. And that's why the insertion of Devon was so smart in there in Rigabi and Mark's interaction, because Mark is leading with all emotion and he has blinders on to what Rigabi is, and he's not protecting himself in the process. So Devon has to be there as a sort of, you keep it between the lines, sort of calming refereeing force.
Devon's the attorney that's assisting in terms of this transaction. You know, yes, I appreciate that role from her. We'll get into this in episode 7, but I kind of actually think that Devon may have a better read on Cobell's usefulness than Rigabi does, because we've gotten to see that Cobell has, in some ways, felt like the faith has spurned her. Not that she's necessarily spurned the faith, but that the cause that she dedicated to is now seemingly turned against her in a way that could be useful. I also think that Cobell has connections to, or his personal goals associated with Jimma, or what Jimma stands for in that bottom floor, more than maybe Rigabi understands. But just in terms of structure, do you want to go into our employee of the episode of this episode and our favorite quotes of this episode, or do you want to go into favorite themes and discussion points in the next episode first?
Well, to finish up the sort of Cobell thing, I mean, I think that Rigabi, as the sort of revolutionary, is unable to process that some of her enemies can change, right? So she's not going to understand when Cobell goes, no, I'm actually against him. Now she's going to go, no, you're one of them. Like, it's all so categorical, black and white for her, that she's not going to be able to do that. I think that very much lines with her character. I think we've talked about everything but the big white whale in the room, is that we seem to know what they're up to with the severance procedure now because of the rotations that Jim is on. It seems to be the commercialization of this technology is going to be, you don't like flying, let's have your innie fly. You don't like writing thank you notes after Christmas, let's have your innie do it. You don't like going to the dentist, let's have your innie do it. And that reveal, I think we all sort of saw that coming with the birthing retreat, right? We kind of saw that that's where this was going. But it does encapsulate the importance for Lumen that innies not be considered people. That is a fundamental part of their business model.
The innies are, beyond just simply slaves, they are an entity that bears the pain that otherwise remove it for your life. As you said, all the things that they leveled out are unpleasant. It's all the, and they, in terms of what we saw Jimmy go through, they're all, the unpleasantness was even heightened for her experiencing them, so they could test to what degree the physical feeling, the emotional feeling, any kind of memory would bleed over into the main her, because that's what they want. They want to make it that you can, you know, remove from yourself all aspects of unpleasantness and pain and just balkanize them out into their own individual rooms. Would I be accurate in saying from what I saw that even the Jimma that's in each of those rooms isn't the same Jimma that's in the other rooms? Not even difference from the main hallway.
I think they're all different.
Yes. It is a separate one that's in each of those. I even wrote them down. It is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. I got 13 different rooms, I think, as I counted, in terms of the ones that they spelled out for us as different places that they're testing on this floor. They're trying to see how many different ones that they can do. All separate, all different aspects of unpleasantness, all with their own separate Gemma, living all of her life only in those individual rooms. Dear Christ, each one is a separate one. 13, 14 separate ones of her, I guess. That is what Lumen's doing. That is what they're testing. That is what they're trying to market to the world, that they can change the world in that way. Because it would. It would remove from life everything that you don't want to handle. It all could be put up in its own little compartmentalized box that's separate and apart and you don't have to think about, because it's no longer you. It's nightmarish as hell and leaves one to question, what's Cold Harbor at this point? What is the final test? What is the final bit of unpleasantness that they need to go through? It leads me to have to believe that Cold Harbor has to be the most personal trauma. It has to be the most difficult. It has to be the most painful and traumatic for Gemma in particular, and that's why they need Mark to reveal it and create it for her. Because that would be the final test. If it's, you know, if you're afraid of snakes, it's going to be immersed in snakes. If you're afraid of falling, if you're afraid of heights, if you're afraid of, I think it might be drowning or something along those lines, because I have some vague memory of that being associated with Gemma. Maybe even the name Cold Harbor could be a bit of a hint in that regard. Though all of them seem to be just city locations around the world. Doing okay there, man? Okay. I'm 100% there with you. They've revealed a lot for the episode. Beyond just simply the emotional journey of seeing those two characters, we got to see the point of severance, it seems, more than anything else, and how much it can be separated out. We got to have some further hints about what Cold Harbor might be, my own little theories in that regard, and Mark's importance to it. We got to have the freaking cards connected and explained to a certain degree about their an aspect of the Lumen manipulation and signing people for mail lists through the birthing center. Dear God. We got to see Lumen's steps in planning in advance of the birthing center, that damn doctor being in the birthing center and the reproductive assistance facility. A lot was revealed there about Lumen's motives and Lumen's tactics and Lumen's patience in terms of making those happen that I wasn't expecting to get. The show's willing to race in certain moments. It just gives me all the more excited for what the final conclusions are going to be. But the fact that they're doing all this and willing to do this all to one person who was clearly kidnapped. I don't believe that car crash happened for a second now. I don't think they plucked her from a hospital. I think they just...
Or she signed up to it, because I thought what they were driving at is that she agreed to do this to have a baby, that they told her that they would help her have a child.
It's possible. It's definitely a possibility. One I would prefer not honestly to ponder. I would almost prefer if she was purely kidnapped and there was no aspect of even trickery. It was just they determined she was an ideal candidate from all of the various mailing lists and experiments and tests that they were doing on her without her knowledge. But it's also perfectly possible that they just simply misled her and signed her up to, you know, go to hell for the sake of something that she desired more than anything else. One thing I want to discuss on that, if we're going into some of the themes in the next episode, the Chikai Bardo, that is a Buddhist concept when I was Googling. It's not one I've been familiar with before. Was it one that you heard of, one you'd heard of or were familiar with?
Let's go back a second, because you covered a lot of stuff before we get to Chikai Bardo. So one thing that happened during that is that I started to cough, and I hit the cough button on the record, but you were still hearing me cough.
I was, yeah.
So what that was a hilarious moment where I think that the audience is going to hear me cough a couple times and then it stopped. And you heard like the real raucous, like hawking, like the last like part, like the dregs of a sickness coming out. And that's why you stopped and you were like, are you good? Do we need to stop? Cause you didn't know that it was not recording. That was a very funny moment for me. All right. So
from the audience perspective, when the moments you heard him cough and then you heard nothing, he just stopped breathing for a minute there. It's like by the end of the minute, even I'm going to be concerned.
I came back to talk to you. It's like, you know, it's like I saw the light, Spencer, but I came back to chat with Spencer about seven.
You went through your own Chikai Bardo, maybe.
I was right at Chikai Bardo and I came out. Look at you. That's such a wonderful segue. So, the last piece on this is I feel fairly strongly that Cold Harbor is, using severance to get rid of your grief. That's the test, right? Mark is the lab rat for the most extreme version of this, and they can't market it unless they can get some sort of proof of concept that it will not break through, that you will not feel it in some way. If you see the person, if you see an image of the person, a picture, whatever. I mean, they are testing it at the extreme by having Miss Casey be talking to him. But I think they're testing the, using the severance procedure to alleviate grief and get rid of grief.
To spend that, then, is there going to, like, is a final test on Miss Casey and whether it bleeds through, is it going to be Mark that's in the Cold Harbor that she sees in some shape or form?
God, I think so.
Fuck those people. Dear Christ.
I think that's where that's going. And then the last piece on this before we get to Chikai Bardo is the integration of the pain of not being able to have a kid. I thought that was really well done. I mean, how that, because, you know, I know people who have dealt with this, and it feels to me like it's a sort of creeping pain. It starts as a thing that, like, okay, it's not working. It's not working for the couple. Maybe they're trying not to talk about it. You don't want to jinx it. Yeah. And then, like, it starts to become such a thing for the couple that maybe they go through some miscarriages that then they start to bicker and argue with each other. And then they start to get really desperate and they spend big money on whatever it is. And they, any promise that it can work. And you, in a very short amount of time, the show showed you that the sort of like early, like, yeah, maybe we'll try the excitement of the first pregnancy and how that sort of creeping pain of, man, this isn't working. This is getting more and more painful that it's not working. This thing I want, it's not happening for me. Led to the desperation for Gemma. I thought that was super well done. And I thought because my read on it was that Gemma agreed to do this so that Lumen would help her have a baby. So let's just go with that for just a second.
Sure.
That in the testing that we see Gemma doing, she has to go back to her Audi. It only works if it goes back to, she goes back to her Audi and then she does the Innie and then goes back to, right? So the Audi has to have Gemma, right? The one who remembers Mark. She has to have some sort of motivation to continue doing this, to be there, to cooperate. Right. What is her raison d'etre? Why is she there? And they gave this backstory of the not being able to have a child, how painful that was for her and Mark. And this is now she's desperate in this role. I thought, man, that's care with a television show that, like, not a lot of TV shows are doing right now, to give a character that rich backstory and motivation that explains why they're in a situation they're in. I kudos to the show. I thought that was really well done.
It's just a wonderful way of expressing the pain of their relationship and that sense of not being able to accomplish something that you've always longed for, whatever else. Seeing Mark, 45 minutes in, disassemble the crib that we'd seen them put together, joke about putting together, was so effective. I never really thought about that process of just seeing that expressed, seeing them go through that, seeing her after retreat from it, find comfort in another friend. Beautifully well handled. So yeah, that having an undercurrent, I'm with you that it's definitely a possibility that could have been in the final temptation. That could have been the final thing that, you know, the devil offers so as to get you to sell your soul in a way that she didn't even fully understand or expect.
And two small things that they did in the course of that storyline that were really affecting for me, because that whole storyline, like, gobsmacked me, is when she's having the miscarriage, she gets in the shower, that she keeps her dress on. That rocked me, right? That sort of, like, if she had taken her dress off to just have a shower, right? I would not have been as affected as her just sort of falling
right there
into the shower as she was. I liked that detail because it was more emotionally impactful. And then also later in that storyline, when Mark turns to her and goes, well, maybe we just quit trying. Maybe it doesn't matter. And you understand what Mark is trying to do. He's trying to say,
trying to be supportive.
He doesn't want to keep, she's put enough pressure on herself in her body. He doesn't want to add to that pressure, but he also compounds the problem by being so flippant about it as if it doesn't matter at all. And you see this sort of impossible situation as a couple they're in, because what is Mark to do? He doesn't want to add to, hey, I, you know, buck up, like, let's get this right. Like, you know, but at the same time, when he's so flippant about it, you can tell it really injures Gemma.
It was so interesting to see the process of different stages of Mark over the course of that series of well-handled flashbacks, of where the first Mark is almost like the perfect blend of Audi Mark and Innie Mark. Of, he was still grounded and professional, but he still felt like he was fun. He was willing to joke. He was willing to be playful. Then we got to see a Mark that felt almost like it was going more into Innie Mark, of where it was very playful, it was very affectionate, it was very loving, and we've not gotten to see as much out of Audi Mark. But over the course of their relationship, as, you know, dreams are deferred, as goals aren't accomplished in the way they want, we got to see a lot more than I expected of Audimark before his wife's death, of where there's an emotional distance, there are barriers being put up, there's less of affection, there's less of a connection. That part of Mark is always there. It's not just trauma. It's not just shock grief. That is how Mark has clearly been handling a lot of these emotional difficult issues long before the loss of his wife. And it was very interesting to see that kind of made apparent.
That was good.
I hadn't expected that to be made apparent in a way that it was, but I thought it was clear to me and very interesting.
Really good parallel there of how Mark handles things. And you saw an early kernel of what blooms later when he's dealing with grief. That really good call out there. Chikai Bardo. Here's all I know of Chikai Bardo is that it's supposed to be that sort of like the phase of death in Tibetan Buddhism. When
transition
the,
kind of thing.
Yeah. But it's always been described to me as the sort of like fork in the road of you either escape the cycle of rebirth, if you have achieved nirvana in your an enlightenment in your life, in your latest life, then you can escape that circle, that sort of like a cycle, or you enter back in sort of to the queue to be born again to another life, and you keep engaging in the cycle of rebirth that is populating the planet. And focusing on that phase of death, I thought was really interesting considering what Jimma goes through on a daily basis, right? Like it's kind of hammer hitting the nail.
She is living her own journey of rebirth and going through the struggles of what that properly means in terms of how the goal ultimately is to escape that.
Right. And that's what she tries to do on the elevator, right? She's trying to escape that constant rebirth. And of course, you know, the terrible part of it is that she has
a different one.
She has no chance, right? Like Milchik just turns her back.
It's interesting too that we had the character herself describe it as ego death, defeating your own psyche, which is certainly an aspect of it when it goes into the faith. And if anything, it gives me a, it certainly well summarized the torture she's going through, but it also gave me a sense of hope as well that there is a possible escape, there is a journey that she's going through. It is her own descent, you know, Dante's Inferno, whatever else you choose to describe of what she's going through, but there is a process here and there is a hope at the end of it. I don't know what that's going to be. I don't know whether it's going to rip my heartstrings even more. I don't know whether it's going to be a greater tragedy for that character if she escapes just in time to lose Mark, given the choices that he's made to try to save her, to descend like Orpheus into hell, or Hades. It gives a sense of resolution, but not necessarily one of triumph in terms of where this journey may be headed.
Anybody who is expecting a positive ending for Gemma, like,
hasn't been paying attention.
You sweet summer child. Like I hope that it happens, but I strongly suspect that they have made us love Gemma because Gemma is the ultimate tragic character in this story. And I don't know if Mark will end up in any sort of romantic relationship, but if it is, it'll have to be with Helen, Helena, right? It'll have to be with her because I think that we're going to see Gemma die at some point.
Question just practically, each of the rooms appears to correspond with the name of a macro data refinement file. They all also appear to be named after towns in the world, like Allentown, where she has to write the Christmas cards forever, where that's my personal hell. That's where I've done wrong and God's trying to punish me to put me in that room for any period of time. But that's just Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Never gotten one Christmas card. Known you 20 years, never gotten a single Christmas card.
If you had a Christmas text for me, you're on a very elite list kind of thing. Yeah, that's the most I'm willing to offer.
Handful of times.
But Allentown, Pennsylvania, Wellington, I guess maybe New Zealand, Zurich, Switzerland. There's Lucknow in India. There's Cold Harbor is the final one. I believe is Virginia. I don't know any of the Cold Harbor. It all appears to be towns that are in the world. Does that have any relevance? Is that just the towns that we're getting to see her or places between things we're getting to see her experience? Or is there any other greater explanation there that I don't get?
I have no idea, but it is interesting. I really don't know, but I'm at with the show. And I'm at this point with the show and I'm not with it with any other show on TV right now that I know of. I trust the process. Like I assume 100%. That they I assume it will mean something, but I can't imagine what it is right now.
All right. Anything further to discuss, or should we discuss winners and losers of the episode, employee of the week for each episode?
I think we got there. We talked about the sort of like, I don't mean that they're not important, but the sort of secondary storylines. And then we hit the real big one at the end of episode 7, where, you know, we kind of get the reveal about what the fuck's going on in this entire story. So yeah, I think we hit it. Let's go to our segments.
My employee of the week for episode 6, Attila, is Helly. The fact that she is Helly again, back in the forefront and leading a revolution, both personal and broad. We didn't even talk about the fact that she, you know, chose to have a relationship with Mark, to have her own memories, to create her own experiences, which is her own profound act of revolt.
Interesting way you put that there, Spencer. Nice.
I tried to be as awkward as Mark without using his language because I couldn't remember what word he used. Did he say they joined vessels or something like that? Was that how you
phrased it? Vessel joining or body joining. It was very strange. But, he didn't have a word for it, which is, you know, I really want to do a deep dive on what knowledge base innies have and what they don't.
He uses sex a minute later. He didn't have to use that word.
None of this makes any sense. Yeah. The language, I mean, that doesn't make any sense. That's what I mean.
Yeah, 100%. Let me see if I can find out what exact word he would use, because I'm just curious. We shared vessels. That was the phrase he used.
Yeah, and it didn't. You know what was cool about that, and shout out again to Britt Lauer, is that Helly didn't seem to understand what he meant when he said that. He had to kind of go a little farther to explain it, because it's such a bizarre phrase that she didn't even really grasp what that meant.
It's like, we had sex. Oh, you and Gemma during, like, you know, a wellness session. No, we did. At the outdoor retreat. Like, there was a walkthrough to get there. But I've often kind of, you know, enjoyed the character as being a hothead who's not necessarily thinking things through, that's responding to them, that her first response to everything is to, you know, burn everything down. See how maturely she handled that information and processed it and direct her anger where it should go and made her own choices going forward about it, what would be best for her and what she wanted? Was so remarkably mature and adult. It is a non-twisted, manipulative, toxic version of what we see Helena capable of that we hadn't previously seen Helly capable of. To again hit to the theme of the show that they are the same person, just with different experiences, demonstrate themselves differently.
I was a little concerned for Mark though, because he was, you know, any Mark was going through the act with Helly, and he kept seeing Gemma.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that they're trying
all kinds of fucked up.
I understand that they're trying to tell us that his memories are blending, but why would that result in him seeing a different person in front of him?
Emotional,
like
love.
Unless what they were doing is they were not trying to display Mark actually seeing Gemma more than him remembering her. That he knew he was still in bed with Helly, mm-hmm. or under a desk or whatever you call that.
But he's associating those memories
with sharing vessels,
new events
with Helly. But he was remembering.
And he's sharing vessels with Audie Mark.
But he just remembered her. Like, that makes more sense, because the idea that he was literally seeing her, I was like, he might be gone. Like, he might be completely broken.
Stands to be seen. We'll see that one. And that my employee of the week for episode 7 is, I hate to say it, but it has to be Gemma. She's doing 13 jobs at once to work for this company. Not willingly, but she's apparently doing them well. It's just the most nightmarish thing that I ever expected to find out of this show.
I think that the more we talk about it, episode 7 is probably the best episode of this series.
It is for me.
And her, God, to be so remarkably attractive and likable and root for a bull, like, you know, mm-hmm. That's such a strong protagonist, and while being put into such a miserable condition and shown to be in such pain and
still fighting,
it was a tour de force of how to put a character through the ringer in 45 minutes. I mean, it conveyed an awful lot. It did so much character work in 45 minutes. I remain very impressed.
It also shows that Mark is very very much enjoys women that are willing to fight to defend and protect themselves. That, you know, to the main acts that we've gotten out of Gemma and Helly when we've got to spend time with them is Gemma coming in over the top with a plastic chair and Helly throwing and threatening to hang herself and throwing staplers at Mark. These are the women he's into are definitely willing to fight.
Yeah, he does get that little smirk on his face, right? When Gemma's raising hell or being just sort of like very willing to stand up for herself and mm-hmm. firm in her beliefs. And Helly, there is a parallel there for sure.
For quotes of the episode, I have a few for episode 6. Britt Lauer just did so wonderfully in terms of just delivering these utter haymakers of lines as Helly, but when she tells Dylan, you said it's behind the poster of you actually being brave. And then a few minutes later going into, did everyone just sever their balls in the elevator this morning? We're just making me laugh. It's like, oh, Helly, we missed you so much. Glad to have you back.
It was like a handful of lines that like removed any doubt that Helena was down there. Like, this is absolutely Helly.
Helena cannot fix this.
No. Not yet. Not until Luke says, please, please, Father.
Oh God, how would you feel if Helena reintegrates and basically tries to, you know, eliminate Helly as a separate person?
Well, obviously that would be like a real nuclear option, right? If the idea of killing Helly is pretty upsetting to the fan base at this point. But I think Helena has to turn as Helena.
Mm-hmm.
Her babyface turn can't be because they integrate the personalities and Helly takes
for us
over
to be with it. Yes.
Because then that just kills her. I think she needs to do it as her outie for me to feel that sort of like to feel that storyline's been fulfilled.
And then I also love the line about where Miss Wong asks her, "Did you punch him?" And she responds, "I mean, not today." Again, made me laugh. But for most like emotionally affecting scene of the episode or level of dialogue, Milchick in the mirror going through, starting with, "You must eradicate your essence of childish folly," into grow up and then grow. That wins it for me in episode 6. For episode 7, All Quiet on the Western Blunt, drug use by enlisted soldiers during World War I. That title alone should get that paper an A. It's such a genius title.
But it's the little things in the writing, right? Because All Quiet on the Western Front was written in the 20s. Mm-hmm. Mark says in season 1 that he taught World War I.
Yeah. They don't need to explain it. We already know it, connecting them.
It's the little stuff, how they take time in the writing.
Devon's line to Rigabi of, "I can tell you're smarter than me, so forgive me if I say this like super plainly, but if you give one solitary thought to messing with my brother again, I will throw you off a fucking bridge." That is a wonderfully crystallized Devon line right there, which I quite enjoyed.
I believe her.
And then one at the end, between the good doctor and Gemma, "You will see the world again, and the world will see you." And her with just this moment of honest hope, like, oh, they're going to be fair about this. They're going to, you know, there is a reward at the end of this torture. So I'll see Mark. And him responding, "Mark will benefit from the world you're siring. Kier will take away all his pain, just as Kier has taken away yours," which was interesting. And then her responding, "Can you please just talk to me like a normal person?" And him closing with, "Good night, Gemma. Dream sweet." Like, no one touched by Kier can be normal. Even if they want to be, even if it's their quest to eventually get away from it, anyone touched by Kier is affected by it and cannot be normal because they just aren't.
I think the creepy doctor did not answer her question because she is going to see Mark, but just not that version of her is going to see Mark.
She, the one he's talking to, no, will not.
She will not.
The, right, the one that walks into Cold Harbor will see Mark in the most horrendous way possible, and they'll see if that bleeds back.
Agreed.
That is all for me, but yet again, closing thoughts. Episode 7 to me was just an utter haymaker of an episode. I'm going to rewatch it because my wife hasn't seen it yet herself, and I'm both looking forward to it and dreading it just because of what effect it had on me watching it the first time. But I guess that just tells you what a wonderfully well done episode it was. And then I don't mean to, like, you know, regard episode 6 as the redheaded stepchild, but it was a good episode in its own right. But it felt more like it was a functional episode rather than it was an episode I'm going to remember and tell other people about.
I'm going to remember the diner scene from that. And I'm going to remember Milchick in the mirror. So there were memorable parts of episode six, but episode seven was, they clearly realized this is going to be I think that'll be the best episode of the season. Like, I think that's an extreme bright spot for this series.
And isn't it great? We got 10 episodes of a season that we can have episodes like this in the middle, and they don't feel like that they're the climax, whatever else. They just feel like they're only setting up even greater things to come.
Are you listening, House of the Dragon? Is this thing on?
Give us a complete story. You're allowed. It's okay, particularly if you're going to take 3 years between seasons.
Are you ready for Dunkin' Egg? That Dunkin' Egg's coming soon.
I want it to be good. It's Dunkin' Egg. They got such wonderful material to make it good, but I still have hopes. I'm just, they're a little bit jaded.
Oh, we're going to watch it. We're totally going to cover it. I don't know.
We're going to watch it, sure, yeah.
We might have to cover it. I don't know how our schedule's going to line up, but yeah, so any other things you want to talk about this week? Any housekeeping, anything on your mind?
No, just a great couple episodes of the television. I'm glad you're on the mend, and fingers crossed we'll be able to talk about episode 8 in a more usual fashion come this next week.
Yeah, thank you all for being patient with us and for being patient with me during this podcast, because I know my voice isn't wonderful to listen to right now, but obviously doing the best I can. Thank you for all your well wishes and for reaching out, and please continue to let us know what you think of the series. Really enjoy the comments online, and a lot of times, when you write in with stuff, either at mangumtalkspodcast@gmail.com or at facebook.com/mangumtalks. When you write in with that stuff, it really does help our conversation, right? I often share it with Spencer. It will frame our episodes and our discussions. So you have an effect on the podcast when you do that stuff, and we really appreciate it. We hope everybody has a great week, and we'll talk to you next week. See you.